It was not popular for Churchill to warn. It never is. All of us like that feeling that all is well. And my only prayer is this, that all is well, though deeply concerned. And with that aside, I want to say, here at this meeting, you mentioned, Mr. President, this is a very large meeting. You use punctilious language in describing the numbers. I remember a certain famous politician who had the largest meeting he'd ever addressed. He was a man who had an unusual capacity with words. He said, ladies and gentlemen, this is the densest audience that I have ever spoken to. That was Adlai Stevenson, the man who could play with words. Far over there in the outside came a voice. We ain't all dense. I do not belong to your party. One of the most effective answers that I've ever heard anywhere. And what has particularly pleased me here, and I've been overwhelmed with kindnesses, the numbers of people who have come to me holding no position today whatsoever, not apologizing for the fact, though, that I have stayed in the House of Commons. I'm glad I did. I can speak there, holding no position in any party, excepting that I'm a member of the Conservative Party. I can speak there as you would speak if you were there, untrammeled, uncontrolled in any way, excepting my responsibilities. I'm getting on in years, they tell me. I don't believe them. I want to do what I can for whatever period lies ahead to try, to continue to try, to make possible the dream of my boyhood. We came west when I was 8 years of age to Fort Carlton, very close to the area that the president lived in. The Red River carts were still moving. I saw the Indian and the Metis grossly and unfairly treated. I saw the beginnings of the mighty migration onto the prairies of Saskatchewan. That's before they started to migrate to BC. I saw them treated in a manner that I regarded as discrimination. And I determined that I would devote my life to ending in my country a discrimination on the basis of race or color or any other reason. People said it was a dream. It could never be achieved. Here this evening, I know that you have representatives of various racial origins. When I was Prime Minister, we had the representatives of 13 different racial origins other than what are called the English and the French. Bringing together the composite capacity, the attainments, the devotion of those who, not forgetting their homeland, have come here to Canada for freedom. That was not a popular stand to take. We had representatives of the Chinese race, Doug Jung, the Italian, German, Czechoslovak, Swedish, Norwegian, Belgian, and so on. Differing racial origins, but all dedicated in their love to Canada. And I've seen it here tonight. I've seen it this afternoon. One of the most interesting things of all is to find these people from Saskatchewan who said, "You remember me? I met you first in 1920. One of them said that today. I said, "I'll call you by name." He'll never get over it. I only met him once. There they were today. The affection poured out to me is beyond anything that I can ever adequately repay by words. There's one lady in this audience, Mrs. Deb Finley. On in years, she knew me in those days. Trying to build the Canada of your dreams and my dreams. And you know, ladies and gentlemen, I don't like repetitions, but I'm tremendously impressed with the young men and women of today. They write me about everything. They asked me all kinds of questions, but there was one from Burnaby that stood in a class by himself. He wrote me, he said, "I heard you on the TV saying that you had letters from boys and girls, and then when they asked you, what do they ask about?" I said, "Everything." "Well, what is the major subject?" "Well," I said, "about 10% want to know how to become prime minister." I might tell them how to become. But I also have to tell them that an end comes to it too. But I don't tell that part. This fellow said, "I don't want to be prime minister. I have enough trouble at home now the way it is. What I want to know is, does a man of 9 have to allow his 11-year-old sister to push him around?" The indignation in that letter. Now, what would you answer? I wasn't discreet. I said, "This is a little out of my depth. I suggest that you get in touch with Women's Lib in Vancouver." Wonderful their attitude, their devotion to Canada, their idealism, far beyond that of my generation. That is my hope for the Canada that lies ahead. Not the 5% of what I call hellraisers. For them I have no use whatever. But the others, with their ideas, whether you accept them or not, nonetheless representative of the results of their thinking. And you'd be amazed the benefits that can come from hearing what they want. And there's the hope of the Canada of the future. No matter how discouraged I may become from time to time by developments, those young people are to me the overwhelming percentage possessed of an intelligence, a capacity, and above all, a desire to serve Canada, to bring about that union within this nation that's so sorely needed today. Because I would be less than frank if I didn't tell you that I have never seen my country divided as it is now. Never. People write me. They're full of fear. They're full of frustration. They wonder where we're going. Covadas. Just recall this, that wherever in the world dictatorship finally came about, unless brought about by force, it's been the consequence of things that have been unjust, that have remained so. And finally, people come to the conclusion that anything could be better than what we have. That's the basis of dictatorship. And I want to see that Canada of my dreams. I won't be here. But I still see the horizons of Canada's greatness, the potentialities far beyond anything that most people have yet realized and appreciated. I want to see that spirit engendered in the hearts of people that we will bring about within this nation. A determination on the part of all people, whatever their racial origin may be, to contribute to that Zion, that city, that nation, in which the principles of justice will be paramount, and which each and all will not judge anyone on the basis of racial origin, but rather on the way in which that person carries out the tremendous challenges of today. Now, I'm not going to say anything more. It's a very simple message. If I were to make a political speech, I would speak longer. It would take longer to recite some of the things that I might deal with. But being in a totally magnanimous state of mind, unaccustomed as I am, I'm going to refrain from doing so. I've known the leaders of the Western world and all of them. I've known the leaders of the Eastern world. Narrow, an amazing personality. He never had a guard. I was with him in Delhi when there were 500,000 people there. He took me downtown. There was a fair on. He said, I never speak to audiences unless they're 500,000. I said, I don't either. He had no guard. I never had a guard. And I wouldn't have one today. Recently, I was speaking in Montreal, and I said, I never had a guard. I'm not speaking around the home, 24 Sussex Street. But I'm speaking about going about as you and I go about. I said, I never had a guard. And then from way over there in the back, somebody, high voice, he said, that's not true. I said, it is true. If I'd have cut him down, I wouldn't have got the next sentence. He said, that's not true. 21 million Canadians guarded you. Ladies and gentlemen, nothing could have pleased me more than that. That if you and I join together in cooperation, we can achieve the impossible. And that's what Canada needs today. Canada needs a message to every part of this nation. To French Canada and English Canada, tremendous number of votes were cast when I was leader of this party in Quebec. Was it cast because, were they cast because I said you're wonderful people? Not at all. I pointed out to them that when they condemn the monarchy, they don't realize that it had it not been for a British king and a British parliament, the rights that they enjoy would never have come into fruition. That they would be in the position of the French Canadians in Rhode Island, Massachusetts, New Hampshire, and so on. If you talk to people with reason, they begin to see the effect. And that's what's needed today. When I said I'm concerned about my country, I am. Not on a partisan basis, but my country above everything else. And if I leave nothing else with you, ladies and gentlemen, than this, each one of you, do something in your own area, in your own organization, in order to bring about that consensus across our Canada and all parts of Canada that will assure strength, stability, and above all, the greatness of our future. From the bottom of my heart, I thank you. I'll never be able to tell you what these 2 days have meant to me. Not unusual, I don't say that, because strangely enough, it's happening to me everywhere across the country. But there's been something about the last couple of days that will always be in my heart and my memory. God bless you all.
Would you like to have to speak after him in the House of Commons? Mr. Diefenbaker, this is the second most thrilling day in my life. The first one was shortly after October 72 when I was elected, and my secretary told me that Mr. Diefenbaker would be speaking in the House of Commons. And I had told her when I first got down there that I wanted to be informed, because one of the things that I was so thrilled about when winning was that I would get to see this great Canadian in operation in our House of Commons, operating on Trudeau, as he says sometimes, without anesthetic. The speech he gave was tremendous. He had the Liberals yelling and screaming at him. And from the back rows, there was an honorable member called Barney Danson, who happens to be in our city these fair days. He wasn't a minister at that time, who was doing his dutiful job yelling across the floor. And Mr. Diefenbaker stopped. He looked at the member, he looked at the speaker, and he said, "Mr. Speaker, I see the honorable member over there. And when he came to this house, I used to think he was a real wit. But I've come to learn over the years that I was only half right." Sir, we want to thank you for being in Delta and White Rock in the past 3 days. I've spent those 3 days with Mr. Diefenbaker, staying in the Vancouver Hotel and in this hotel. And for that, I must also thank my wife, because she hasn't seen me for 3 days. But how many people in their lifetime would get the opportunity of spending 3 days having breakfast, lunch, and dinner with such a great Canadian? And I will never forget it, sir. It's been one of the highlights of my life. We've enjoyed your speech tonight. I know the people here have been thrilled with it. We would like you to take back to your wife, Mrs. Diefenbaker, our prayers and our love tonight. We know that we've kept you here a little longer than we should have, and she'll be waiting for your arrival. So I won't say any more than thank you. We've been privileged.